after the bitterness of the previous winter. The army had left a couple of generators behind, and it was now obvious where one of them was in use, and the sight of it set John on edge, given how much fuel was being used just to provide lighting. For a moment, he stood there wondering if he was feeling the cooling touch of air conditioning as well. "John Matherson of Black Mountain?" John felt a bit embarrassed. He had actually been standing there as if he were a gape-mouthed tourist, gazing up at the electric lights. He caught sight of the man he assumed was Dale Fredericks coming out of his office, located on the ground floor of the courthouse. There was a friendly enough smile as the man approached, hand extended, which John took, and there was a firm enough handshake. Dale stood half a foot shorter than John, light sandy hair worn a bit long and combed across his forehead to cover the fact that his hairline was receding. He was wearing a blue jacket, standard light blue shirt and red tie, the way most professionals dressed before everything had gone down. John didn't know if the man's clothes were setting him off or if they were actually a touch of reassurance that somehow, in some ways, things were coming back to normal. It made John awkwardly aware of his own well-worn dress shirt, collar frayed and permanently darkened from sweat, his jeans and hiking boots both a bit the worse for wear as well. Dale's face was round. Again a strange sight in a way for the survivors of what they now called the starving times, which had left a permanent mark on all who had survived it. Perhaps the only positive thing that could be said of those days was that the Americans' slide into near-universal obesity had finally come to a stop. Something else caught John's attention. The man was freshly showered and shaved, a fact that made John feel suddenly out of place. Dale's pale gray eyes darted to Michaela. His smile broadened slightly, and he offered his hand, which Michaela took firmly, introducing herself. "I assume this is Mrs. Matherson. My assistant told me you were coming."
"It's Michaela Turner Matherson," she replied, her smile as broad as his. "Director of Public Health and Safety for our community, and I assume you are Dale Fredericks." There was a slight flicker of a frown from Dale, and then he regained instant composure over his faux pas.
"Oh, sorry, I did not properly introduce myself. Yes, I am Dale Fredericks."
She gave a sidelong glance to John, as if nudging him. Though he felt comfortable with all of the aspects of his jobs as a colonel, a college professor, and the one who took on the role of near-dictator operating under martial law during the darkest days of the crisis, there were nuances of the games of diplomacy at which he knew Michaela was superior, and he caught it now as if she were saying, "Don't let the fact that the guy is clean and well-dressed put us off."
"If my administrative assistant had clearly understood who was calling, she most certainly would have scheduled you in. Please accept my apologies for the confusion. Let's go into my office and see what I can do for you."
He led the way, graciously helping Michaela to take a seat and offering water, which both Michaela and John accepted. To John's utter disbelief, the water was freezing cold.
"Oh, that?" Dale replied with a chuckle. "Indeed a luxury, I realize. We have an old-fashioned water cooler. I know it's a bit of an excess, but on some of these hot days it means a lot for staff morale."
"Did I feel air conditioning when we came in?" Michaela asked innocently.
"It really did feel wonderful."
"We turn it on for a few minutes each day," Dale said.
"Oh, how wonderful," Michaela whispered, and then she set her glass down after only one sip.
There was a moment of nervous silence, and Dale cleared his throat, pale eyes fixed on John.
"I think I can guess why you came here today, but why don't you open the discussion? But I have to warn you, I'm really tied up today, so we'll have to keep it fairly short for now."
John pulled Elizabeth's draft notice out of his pocket and put it on the table. Before he could speak, Dale leaned over, took it, and held it up.
"Your daughter?"
he asked.
"For starters, yes."
Dale smiled disarmingly.
"Well, in that case, I know I can work an arrangement for you. We'll figure out some sort of deferment."
John now actually did sit up straighter, and Michaela gently reached over and put a light restraining hand on his arm.
"I didn't come here to just plead for my daughter, sir."
Dale's features clouded for a second, and his gaze dropped.
"Oh, I'm sorry. Forgive me, sir," Dale replied hastily.
You see, these notices started going out a couple of weeks back. Mail to your town was a bit delayed, so it only went out there with this morning's delivery from our post office. It's why I'm in semi-hiding at the moment, he said with a rueful chuckle. I've got parents, wives, husbands, kids all pleading for deferments. I actually had a mother try to bribe me yesterday with a pie that had a silver dollar stuck in it, so please excuse me if I misspoke. I know an honorable man such as you would not come here just to ask for special treatment for a member of his family.
John nodded, even feeling a touch of understanding. Across the last 2 years, he had presided over many a hard decision, the most dreadful of them executions, first starting with the two young men who had stolen medications from the nursing home. He never regretted or second-thought the decisions once made, affirming to himself that in taking one life he had spared others anguish and deterred a descent into anarchy. Nevertheless, the appeals of loved ones and having to firmly say no could be grueling. And attempts at bribes ranged from what could just be called a friendly neighborly gesture of some rations or a bottle of bootleg moonshine appearing on his doorstep with a friendly note attached to outright criminal threats.
Thus the reaction of the guards outside the building when we first came in, Michaela ventured.
Ah, yes, regrettable but necessary, Dale replied. Otherwise that foyer out there would be swamped. Apologies if it seemed rude.
I understand, but I would suggest that your man out there gets a little training in proper procedure and some basic manners.
I'll have a talk with him, John, Dale said with an apologetic smile, brushing an errant lock of hair back from his forehead. So how can I help you?
I'm here on behalf of many of the citizens of Black Mountain, Montreat, and Swannanoa, John said. It is not just about my daughter.
I see,
Dale replied, leaning back in his swivel chair, bringing his fingertips together and resting his chin on them.
Many of the citizens, you say?
I didn't speak to everyone who got the notices this morning, but I dare say, yes, it will be the majority. Our first question, just what is this all about? We hear nothing from the federal government for a year. After the worst of the crisis is over, an army battalion shows up, but then they are pulled out. And now these notices of draft into this new organization, this ANR. I have an understanding of the need to create a centralized force to restore this nation, but on the other side of the coin, these notices were a shock that hit without warning. I'll also add that nearly all of those being drafted are citizens crucial to my community, not just for protection, but also for food production and our first steps at rebuilding. It comes as a tough blow.
Dale stood up and sighed. He walked about behind his desk for a moment and then pointed to an old map of the United States on the wall behind his desk.
The federal government is reconstituting at last, Dale announced, and he nodded toward the map.
The gesture seemed a bit ham-handed to John, a professor for many years, but he could sense that Dale was nervous in building a case, so he did not show anything other than a forced expression of interest.
The situation overseas, though unstable, is at least for the moment relatively calm. Our overseas nuclear assets survived intact, and, as you undoubtedly know, a swift and terrible retribution was rained down on North Korea and Iran. After that, secondary wars did break out, such as the conflict raging now between India and Pakistan, which we are standing clear of. There are numerous low-intensity wars raging around the globe. The only thing ensuring our security is the certain knowledge that our nuclear boomers are still out there under the seas ready with swift retaliation if there is another launch against the United States. Wish we had made that message clearer before the day,
Michaela said softly, her voice filled with bitterness.
We all do,
Dale replied. John said nothing. Was it really Iran and Korea, or were others involved? Those were questions for which no one had a clear answer. If it had been Russia that provided technical support for the attack, they were suffering now as well because an EMP burst, which, believed by some to have been off course, had detonated over Eastern Europe rather than what many assumed was the target of Western Europe. Moscow and St. Petersburg had ceased to exist in the months afterward, the same as every major city in America.
But here, Dale continued, we are struggling to regain our national borders. The rhetoric with the so-called Chinese raid and fraternity mission is clearly transitioning into a permanent occupation force. The president has decided that we must mobilize for this national emergency, and thus the letters arrived here in Asheville shortly after my own arrival. John, I wish I had been able to establish better community relations with everyone after arriving here before these draft notices hit. All our regular military assets and the army that existed prior to the attack that have returned to the continental United States are being shifted to our southern and western borders. The new Army of National Recovery is therefore needed to help reestablish order and government control in the rest of the country. I heard how you organized the fight against a group called the Posse and soundly defeated them. John, there are still scores of posse-like groups wandering the countryside, some of them in our own backyard, such as these so-called reaver groups harassing law-abiding communities like yours. I tell you.
He sighed, sitting back down in his chair, taking a long drink of cold water, and then setting the glass down.
This was not what I thought my job would be when I first got here. I thought it would be to help network communities together, stitch back the fabric of our society, getting us working again as a single team as we did in the old days, and our flag would again represent a real working nation and not just a memory. It was a shock to me when orders came down to mobilize several thousand out of my district for national service, and that my first job was to be the bearer of these tidings.
He nodded toward the draft notice resting on the desk between them, his features remorseful.
"Whoever thought this up, the selection of personnel, I assume it is not you?" John asked.
"Oh, definitely not. Most definitely not."
"Well, whoever did is clueless about the situation here. We barely hung on by the skin of our teeth when the posse hit us a year and a half ago. I assume you are aware of that situation?"
"I know about the fight you put up and your leadership. A masterful victory."
"It was a bloody slaughter for both sides. If that is the definition of victory, I pray I do not have another like it. The young men and women receiving draft notices are the backbone of our internal defense force. We've had a dozen incidents since with raiders, gangs of thieves, and now these reavers just on the other side of Mount Mitchell. Strip out the backbone of my command, and we are defenseless."
"Your command?"
Dale asked softly. John hesitated and then nodded.
"Yes, I am commander of the local self-defense force."
"Isn't it perhaps time that we begin to shift that a bit, to work together more as a team, bring back state and federal authority? That is the intent of the Army of National Recovery, a federally organized force to bring stability back to America nationwide. When fully in place, local communities will no longer have to fend for themselves. I would think that would actually be welcome news for you, John."
John was silent with that. Of course that was an ideal, but how could they make it a working, functional ideal?
"When I can see and feel clearly that such is the case and that our local security is firmly in place, maybe then I'd feel more comfortable with so many of my community's personnel being pulled out for duty elsewhere."
"The times are no longer Fort Apache on the frontier or medieval barons holed up in their castles," Dale replied. "It is time to bring back a broader authority and stability."
"But stripping out the core of the strength of my community now, I'd like to see something else in place first."
"In fact, you're about to see that, John. I have assets reporting in this weekend that I think you'll find to be rather impressive and definitely reassuring. I wish they'd come in first before the draft notices went out. Their presence would have alleviated your concerns about defense of your community in the future."
"Like what?"
"I've been promised some air support, for starters."
"Air?"
"Not for public consumption, so keep that under your hat for now. For some folks here, I'd prefer it to be a surprise, if you know what I mean."
"Air support from where? Nearly everything stateside was fried by the EMP.
"Again, not allowed to discuss that. Let's just say some overseas equipment is finally making its way back here. The government decided some of it can be spared as needed by local administrative areas. I put in a strong request, so even as your personnel head off for training, I'll have some darn good backup in place for your community in this entire region. Is that fair enough?"
"We'll see, but There is a second question just as burning. Just where in the hell are these kids going to serve with this ANR?
R's not the reason why,
Dale said softly.
There's but to do and die,
Michaela interjected. Dale looked at her a bit taken aback, and John realized that Dale did not know the line from the ironic poem.
Tennyson describing the disaster of the chart of the Light Brigade in a long-ago war,
Michaela said.
That is not a fate for any of the young men and women of our town. I spoke too flippantly, forgive me,
Dale replied.
John,
he hesitated and then nodded to Michaela.
And you too, ma'am. I have no idea as to where your daughter will be assigned. This is a national mobilization, a million strong. We need to constitute an army within our own continent. Most of our military based here in the States when all this started was as decimated as the civilian population. We have at best a few hundred thousand under arms within our borders. We have to secure our borders, hopefully just by a show of will.
Why not just federalize the National Guard? John asked.
Good question, John. That was seriously discussed, but it was quickly realized it would be all but impossible. The high casualty rate within the United States decimated Guard members, the same as everyone else. Databases have been lost, and there isn't a single state government that is running efficiently enough to coordinate bringing Guard units into national service. It was realized we needed to start from scratch again, and thus the Army of National Recovery. This force, once created, will not even have to fight other than containing lawlessness in some regions. Once our borders are resecured, the military can return to its mission of stabilizing places still in chaos. When that happens, the ANR stands down and all your sons and daughters will be back home by Christmas.
I seem to recall that kind of promise at the start of nearly every war,
Michaela replied coolly.
They'll be home by Christmas. That is most reassuring.
There appeared to be a glint of anger in Dale's eyes, even though he held his smile without flinching.
I'll tell you what,
he said, standing up, clearly indicating the meeting was drawing to a close.
I can at least do this, but for heaven's sakes, don't let anyone outside your community know this. The notice is said to report here in 3 days. Let's just say that was a misprint, and it is 30 days hence. That will give me time to file your concerns back to Bluemont and give you a chance to see that I am a man of my word when it comes to the fact that I promise we'll have a region-wide defense force in place to cover for communities such as yours, so that you no longer need your small independent commands, and I'll see if I can better clarify terms of service. Is that fair for right now?
John hesitated, but then finally nodded in agreement. He looked over to Michaela, who smiled, nodded as well, and actually said,
Thank you, sir.
Good. Then that's settled. Now, you must excuse me. I am swamped, which I think you can understand. Get back to your people, calm things down, and we'll be in touch and see what can be done, let's say, in a week or so. Does that work for you?
John stood and nodded.
And please don't construe this the wrong way. Your daughter's age?
18, and she is the mother of a 14-month-old boy whose father was killed in the fighting with the posse. He hesitated, ashamed to mention it, as if seeking sympathy, but it spilled from him.
Her younger sister died of diabetes last year as well. She is all we have left.
Dale looked at Michaela with soulful eyes.
I am sorry about the loss of your daughter, ma'am. I know deferments for draftees with dependent children have been dropped, but, and again, please don't take this the wrong way. I think you have good grounds for an appeal that I can move forward, especially if she is serving as your assistant or in some capacity vital to the area's security beyond that of just simply carrying arms.
Elizabeth is my adopted daughter,
Michaela replied,
and at the moment she serves in the local militia, helps with the community farm acreage, and takes care of her son and her grandmother, just like so many of the other kids in our community.
She stared straight at him, and his eyes dropped.
We've all lost someone, he said.
And you?
He hesitated.
Strange, but maybe lucky. I had no one special when the day hit. I was part of the personnel evacuated out of Washington. I had two sisters. We were never close, really. I married some years ago and then divorced and lost track of where my ex was even before the war hit us, and so I just buried myself in work.
Such as?
Michaela pressed. There was a look in his eyes, but it passed like a shadow.
working for the federal government, of course, to try to bring order out of chaos. I was ordered to report up to Bluemont to help with the work of reorganization and then was assigned to the field, meaning here, 2 months ago. Now, if you'll excuse me, I really am late for my next meeting. I'll take care of the 30-day extension on the draft in your community and we'll be in touch. I know you'll clearly see that our district has become safe for law-abiding citizens within a matter of days.
John looked at him quizzically, but long experience told him that this man was not going to say anything more. He had at least gotten a temporary reprieve for his entire community. Whatever Frederick's actions were going to be, he'd have to let him play them out. Dale stepped out from behind his desk, opened the door to his office, and motioned for Michaela, who nodded her thanks as she exited with John following her. Dale shook John's hand in the hallway and then returned to his office while they headed for the exit and out into the early afternoon heat. John spared a sharp glance for the sergeant who had troubled him earlier, but the man's gaze was fixed straight ahead as if John didn't exist. John and Michaela walked slowly to where Ed and Grace were leaning against the hood of the Edsel.
"What do you think?" Michaela whispered.
"Well, I didn't expect the extension. I'm highly skeptical that a central government can secure our communities. We understand the nuances and threats better than they ever can. If they had shown up with 1 million extra rations as a reserve for the winter ahead, some farming equipment, electrical generators, additional communications gear, some tech people to help us get things up and running, or a darn good, fully stocked field medical unit that can move from community to community, now those would be blessings I'd be overjoyed to see. That's the kind of help I was hoping for, not this pulling out of those we need the most, not just for defense, but also for rebuilding."
"All of those would be great,"
Michaela replied.
"I don't like the idea of them being plucked from our midst, and 6 weeks from now they're thrown into some godforsaken no man's land fighting posse groups in New York or the nightmare in Chicago."
He sighed as they headed to the car where Ed and Grace stood, weapons slung, both of them relieved to see John and Michaela out of the building and heading their way.
"If everything he said is true, it is essentially a lawful order of the emergency government, but to go against it?"
Michaela said. He shook his head ruefully.
"I was a military man once, Michaela. I swore an oath to defend the Constitution, and as long as that point held, I followed orders even when I didn't like them. I feel caught in the middle with this thing. This is about Elizabeth, but also about damn near every other family I feel responsible for."
"Let's go home and try to calm things down first. They certainly didn't volunteer to come with us. And once we get back, you have that postponed appointment with your friendly dentist, Doc Wiederman."
The mere mention of it reminded him of the damn toothache. The crisis of the moment had diverted him from the pain, but mention of it was a forceful reminder. She gave him that reassuring nurse smile that usually meant what was coming would not be pleasant. He sighed and nodded.
"What do you think?"
he asked.
"About your tooth or Dale?"
she asked.
"Dale."
She took his hand and squeezed it.
"I think he's full of shit."
Chapter 3.
"Come on in, John. No more dodging now."
Richard Wiederman was an old friend from long before the day, the family dentist who had taken care of his kids and had even belonged to the town's Civil War Round Table group. Richard took delight in giving talks on what medicine and dentistry were like back then, and that knowledge had put him into an important position after the day. Gone were pneumatic-driven high-speed dental drills and suction tubes, and the mere sight of a Novocaine needle always creeped John out. When John came in for checkups, he used to nervously joke with Richard about a favorite comedy musical that featured an insane dentist who winds up getting fed to a man-eating plant. Everyone had some sort of dark joke about dentists, but on the other hand, all were darn grateful for their existence and took it as an ordinary part of their lives, even if it was a few unpleasant hours a year in the chair. No longer. Richard's supply of Novocaine and other anesthesia had immediately gone into the town's emergency supply. He had become more than just a dentist during the battle with the posse, helping to patch up facial wounds and repair shattered jaws and agonizing wounds to the mouth. In the year and a half after those dreadful days, he had resumed his practice, using what had been a hobby knowledge of dental history
to put himself back into business. In the basement storage room of a long-deceased dentist, he found a foot-powered treadle drill and a variety of dental tools not used in 100 years. From a hidden reserve in a jewelry store, he snatched up thin sheets of hammered-out gold for fillings. He had moved his office from a posh location in an upscale development at the edge of town into an abandoned jewelry store on Cherry Street, where reluctant patients came for treatment. There was even a hand-lettered sign over the entryway painted in ornate 19th-century script, complete with the image of a tooth proclaiming, "Pain-free extraction." That, at least, was no longer just an advertising line. The chemistry teacher at the college had put together a team at Michaela's behest, and they had actually managed to start the production of ether. It had, after all, first been manufactured in the early 19th century with supplies and equipment any modern college or even high school chemistry classroom lab could duplicate. When first discovered in the early 19th century, and for nearly 40 years afterward, ether and nitrous oxide were not used for medical purposes, but instead for what could be called stoner parties. The ether man traveled from town to town with bottles of ether and tightly woven bags containing the nitrous oxide to be dispensed at 2 bits a whiff, a favorite form of entertainment. It was finally a dentist in Georgia in the early 1840s who had connected the dots that ether was far more than just entertainment. The Civil War historian in John was always grateful for that realization when he contemplated the agony of the hundreds of thousands of wounded who, if the war had been fought but 20 years earlier, would have gone under the saw and knife wide awake. Ether and chloroform were readily available then, and they were even sent through the lines as a humanitarian gesture if an enemy's hospital was running short. The tragedy after the day was that the art of making anesthesia locally had to be relearned, and thus many of the wounded after the war with the posse had indeed suffered. After that experience, Michaela made it a top priority for the college lab to resume manufacturing the precious gas and fumes, along with silver-based antibiotics. As Richard motioned for John to take a seat in the chair, he looked around the office and felt that it indeed had a Civil War-era look to it. A wood stove in the corner was burning, in spite of the heat of the day, to sterilize instruments in a boiling pot, X-ray readers and a computer screen providing soothing images to divert a patient in the chair were replaced with some old-fashioned charts of the mouth and teeth. Gruesome, but illustrative when Richard had to point out where a problem was. John tried to settle back into the chair, Richard gossiping with him for a few minutes about the draft. His oldest daughter was one of those called up. And then the moment came. "Come on, John, open up, let's take a look." Then the dreaded, "Ah, I think this is the one." He tapped the sore tooth with the end of a probe, nearly sending John out of the chair. Richard sat back, nodding thoughtfully. "In the old days, I'd send you to a specialist for a root canal. I don't even need an X-ray to tell you this one is bad. I can have it out in 2 minutes, John." John looked at him wide-eyed. "I'll skip it for now, Rich," he replied hoarsely. "Maybe in a couple of days after things settle down, I got a couple of meetings to attend to later today." "Come on, John, I even got ether now. Have you under tooth out and you're on your way an hour from now?" John shook his head. "I got to be clear-headed, too much going on at the moment." "I think you're begging off, John," Richard replied with a knowing smile. "Yeah, well, maybe I am. Open your mouth again." "Why?" "I thought I saw something else. Promise I won't touch the sore tooth, but John, you and I know that kind of thing actually used to kill people 200 years ago. It's an upper molar. Gets you infected, gets into your sinuses, and then you got real agony that could eventually kill you. Come on, let's get it taken care of." John kept his mouth closed and shook his head, willing himself to think that it really didn't hurt all that bad and could wait. "Well, at least let me take a quick look, see it's something else. Promise I'll leave that bad boy alone." John reluctantly complied. Richard leaned in, tapping John's lower left canine, and John winced a bit. "Yeah, I thought so," Richard announced while still peering into John's mouth. Start of a cavity that could go nasty there.
All John could do was mutter a strangled,
"Damn it. I can take care of that nice and quick,"
Richard continued, sitting back up and rubbing his hands on his apron. Gone were the days of latex gloves and masks, the few in the town's supply reserved for major surgeries only.
"Drill that sucker out in 5 minutes and pack a filling into it."
John looked at him wide-eyed.
"Compromise with you, John. Let me fill that before it goes bad, and you get off free until tomorrow with the bad one. Otherwise, I go to Michaela, and she lays some mandatory treatment order on you as the public health official."
John glared angrily at Richard for pulling that trump card and finally nodded a reluctant agreement. Richard smiled, and whistling, he went over to the boiling pot, tossed in the instrument he had been using to probe John, and pulled out several others with tongs. John tried to look the other way as Richard pushed the foot-powered drill up alongside the chair and clamped a drill bit in. It was yet another reason why, before the day, John would shake his head when folks waxed too enthusiastically about the alleged beauty of living in the 19th century. They never thought about medicine and sanitation, let alone dentistry. Richard pulled out a rubberized bag from under a counter. It looked like an oversized balloon with a nozzle on each end.
"I'll open the tap on this,"
Richard said with a grin.
"You take a good deep breath in. Nitrous will chill you out for a few minutes."
Richard stuck the nozzle into John's mouth and then opened the valve.
"Go for it,"
Richard said, and he did have a bit of a maniacal grin as John breathed in deeply. Within seconds, it hit, and John actually did feel mellowed out, even giddy, as Richard closed the valve, put the bag down, swung the old-fashioned drill around in front of John, and started to pedal furiously. There was a low humming as the oiled cables spun in their sprockets, the drill bit spinning. Richard moved quickly, prying John's mouth open and pushing the drill bit down onto the cavity. John felt like his entire head was vibrating, the sound of the drill bit flashing him back to early childhood, a dreaded dentist who had yet to go high-tech and used an old-fashioned cable-driven drill, but at least that one was electrically powered. For the first minute or so, it didn't really bother him. In fact, he was tempted to crack a joke. There was pain within seconds. But for a blessed moment, he really didn't care. It was strange how nitrous allowed one to feel pain but not care about it. And then it hit. The gulp of nitrous was wearing off. The treadle-powered drill was setting up an awful racket. He felt like his mouth was vibrating apart and the pain was building. He started to gasp, waving his arm for Richard to stop.
"Hang in there, John. Just another minute. Almost got it all."
Gone was the electrical-powered suction tube. John's mouth was filling up with saliva and drilled out bits of tooth, and it smelled like something was burning. He began to gag, waving frantically for Richard to back off. Richard pulled the drill out and held up an old-fashioned spittoon, John gagging, spitting, and cursing.
"Think I got it all,"
Richard stated.
"Think you got it all?" John cried. "Well, you were putting on such a show there." "You're damn right. I swear you're a sadist, Richard."
Richard grinned.
"I'll pack it with a filling and we're done."
There was no argument. John couldn't very well walk out with a hole in his tooth on top of the other one that was throbbing away. Richard opened a drawer in the old-fashioned white enamel-top table behind him, drew out a tissue-thin sheet of gold, clipped off a small piece, gingerly rolled it up, and then worked it with a miniature-sized jeweler's hammer, turning it over and over. He finally picked it up with a pair of tweezers and dropped it into a petri dish filled with moonshine that served as an antiseptic wash.
"Now rinse good, make sure the stuff gets into that tooth and it's okay to swallow."
Richard handed him a mason jar of clear white lightning, and John did as ordered, nearly yelping with pain as the high-test moonshine swirled around his aching tooth as well as the one that Richard had drilled. He so wanted to swallow, but thoughts of the town meeting to come caused him to spit it out into the bucket. Though Richard was not above a quick swig for himself before getting back to work, fishing the gold filling out of its antiseptic wash, after another agonizing minute he had it firmly worked into the drilled-out hole.
"They're all done," Richard announced proudly. "Don't chew on that for a few days. If it starts to get infected, get in here. And I definitely expect you back in here in another day so I can get that rotting tooth out of you before it really goes bad. We can't fool around with those things the way we used to. Remember, old man Parker died last month from a tooth infection.
John could only nod.
Now both sides of his mouth hurt. How much do I owe you?
He muttered, standing up.
Let's see, one drilling, one filling with gold foil. Make that a buck in silver. That covers the cost of the gold more than anything else. We'll say a buck in silver or 20 rounds of ammo. Prefer 22.
John fished into his pocket and pulled out a well-worn barber quarter and two mercury dimes. Over the previous year, silver money, hoarded by more than a few before the day, had started to slip back into circulation as money that was accepted by nearly all.
All I got on me. Can I pay you the rest tomorrow? Yeah, but that tooth pull, that'll be an extra 50 cents, Richard said with a smile. Only 25 cents if you want to skip the ether.
Yeah, right, John sighed.
I'll be back tomorrow and pay you the rest then, along with the extra 2 bits for ether when you pull the tooth out, okay?
Richard smiled and nodded.
You'd definitely better be back in, John. It's no joking matter, and you know that better than most. Stupid to die because of a lousy tooth after all you've been through.
John all but fled the office and then turned to walk up Cherry Street, pausing to look in nostalgically at the used bookstore, a favorite haunt before the day. The owner had died in the battle with the posse. It had been turned into a borrowing library by his friend's widow. Bring a book in to trade for one taken out. And it thus continued to flourish, but he missed his old friend, the games of chess over coffee, a world where he did not face the situation waiting just around the corner. A sign hung on the door. Closed for the town meeting, chess tournament later tonight. Nearly 500 had shown up in the town square for the hastily called gathering to find out the news about John's visit to the new federal administrator. The pig roast lent a slightly festive air to the occasion. It wasn't every day, or even week or month, when an open meal was offered to the town without requirement of ration cards, and more than a few showed for the roasted pork and then wandered off if their families were not directly affected by the draft. Phil, a favorite in the town where everyone still spoke nostalgically of his legendary barbecue restaurant, had presided over the roasting. He complained that he should have been given a week or so to properly prepare the wild boar, but John had left word with him to do his best and have it ready by 6 for the sake of all, which he faithfully did. The fire pit had been burning all day, Phil butchering off hunks of meat from the wild boar and just roasting them over the fire, muttering throughout the hot day that if given the time, he could have made the 600-pound boar into a real feast. The meat was tough, but at least edible, and any meat, especially in mid-spring, was welcome after the long, lean days of winter. There was nearly 500 of meat for everyone present, and that had settled things a bit. Eventually, though, the meeting degenerated into angry questions, fueled primarily by Ernie Franklin and his extended family of kin and followers. John had no answers to give Ernie other than the fact that the draft had been pushed back to 30 days, that Fredericks had promised that assets were coming in to ensure public safety, and that the federal government was finally started to reach out to their region. It was a bit difficult to speak clearly. His mouth was still throbbing from the ordeal with Richard, so it was a relief to announce he had another meeting to get to. He turned things over to Reverend Black and, with a sigh of relief, piled into the old Edsel with his family for the 3-mile trip up to the college campus and Lake Susan to an event John had been looking forward to for a long time. Paul and Becca Hawkins had arranged for the secret meeting up at Lake Susan long before the crisis over the draft had hit. Paul was one of the IT guys for Montreat College, and Becca was an assistant librarian. Both were students who had stayed on after graduation, found jobs at the college, and then eventually married. After the day, the library, the place where they hung out together as students, had become their permanent home when they set up an apartment in the basement. Friends familiar with the old Twilight Zone series joked that the couple reminded them of a famous episode starring Burgess Meredith, in which a bookworm finds paradise in a library after a nuclear war. Their shared passion was poking around old books and magazines, looking for anything that might be helpful to the community, such as articles in Mother Earth News on how to identify which mushrooms were safe to eat.
6 months before, they had finally hit the motherlode of treasures. The reason it had taken so long to find this particular treasure trove was twofold. Years earlier, the library had gone over to electronic cataloging. The old card filing system, once so familiar in all libraries, had finally been carted to a back room and not updated since the turn of the century. Anything that had come in since had simply been entered into the campus database. Now long lost, of course. One of the great weaknesses of the now lost digital age was its total dependence on electronic databases rather than old-fashioned backups with ink on paper. A poignant pastime for some was to gaze at a dust-covered iPhone, trying to remember something called phone numbers of friends and even that of children and parents. Older folks could still rattle off a number and address from a quarter century earlier, but from the day before all systems went down? Where were the addresses, even photographic images of life in the decade before the day now? It was symbolic of just how much had been wiped out of their lives, most likely never to return. Thus, in the library, as in so many millions of other locations, from federal government offices down to iPhones and iPads, nearly all data from the decade prior to the attack had been lost. The second factor behind the long delay of discovering the hidden treasure was that every spring, locals emptying out attics and garages would haul thousands of moldering books and magazines into the library for the annual 4th of July book sale and fundraiser. Of course, the sale had never happened after the war started, and the hundreds of boxes of donations were all but forgotten in the basement. It took the Paul and Becca prowling around the damp, moldy basement for yet more curios and things interesting to read to find the treasure. A complete set of the Journal of the AIEE, the American Institute of Electrical Engineers, dating all the way back to 1884. Nearly anyone else in the world would have consigned the moldy, sneeze-inducing magazines to the kindling pile, but fortunately, not those two. Months earlier, they had burst into John's office. Unlike most in the town, they still called him Doc out of memory of his days as their history professor, and tossed a dusty, brittle magazine on his desk without preamble or explanation. "Doc, this is a gold mine," Paul cried. "They even got the first edition here from 1884, and check this out, articles actually written by Tesla, Nikola Tesla himself." It had been a quiet, snowy day when they arrived, and he had indeed been in a mellow mood after a romantic night with Michaela in front of the fireplace and no new crisis to deal with, so he was initially in an indulgent frame of mind. Hardly a day passed without someone presenting a hare-brained idea to solve the town's problems with everything from cold fusion machines to perpetual motion. When Mabel's husband George first walked in with plans for how to run a car off charcoal fumes, he thought the man crazy, but a year later, half a dozen such vehicles were chugging around the community. As a professor, John had always turned to Paul when it came to the inevitable computer glitches in his classroom, and Becca could always track down some obscure journal via interlibrary loan for an article he was writing, so of course he would listen to them. Within minutes after they dumped the journal on his desk, he was as excited as they were. They brought in a box of the journals and spent a delightful afternoon poring over them. Beyond being the one-time head of this town, he was a historian, and the journals were a remarkable glimpse into a most remarkable time in global history, where the world was coming out of the darkness and into the future brilliance of electrical power, and in so doing would set itself up for the greatest disaster in human history since the great plagues of the 14th century. The monthly journals dated all the way back to the first days of the electrical industry, the infamous current wars, the conflict between Edison on one side supporting the use of direct current and Tesla and Westinghouse on the other pushing for alternating current, had been fought out for years on the pages of the magazine. Historically, that was interesting enough, but far more important were the details of the genesis of the modern electrical current grid, from generating station to transformers to household appliances, with detailed plans and patents set out for everything. It was a time of excitement and new inventions nearly every month. It was also a time of bitter infighting, turf wars, patent arguments, claim jumping on who invented what first, character assassinations, and outright thievery and sabotage. Becca's librarian skills came to the fore as she laboriously indexed and cross-indexed the material they had uncovered. That was an essential step, since the magazines had been printed on cheap, wood-pulp-based paper, and many were as brittle as glass, about to disintegrate if handled more than a few times. The secrets of the past could literally disintegrate in a reader's hands, and she therefore became their guardian, ensuring the magazines were not pawed over in a frivolous manner. What she was protecting covered the development of the entire industry, from just a few years after the first commercial incandescent light bulbs and power plants went online up until the 1960s, when the AIEE had merged with another organization to include Advanced Electronics, unknowingly beginning to lay the groundwork for disaster with an increasingly delicate infrastructure. The library had already proven its worth innumerable times over since the day. There had been a rush to uncover half-forgotten issues of Mother Earth News and the Foxfire series of books for some retro learning about food gathering and preparation. The college had set up seminars for students and the general public to teach canning, mushroom gathering, hunting, trapping, and folk medicine. But this? It was like some lost tablets had been found by archaeologists that would explain a forgotten language, a language that could unlock one of the great secrets of the universe, how to restore electrical power. More than a few, especially the ham radio operators and a few other hobbyists, understood how it all had once worked, but to see the actual diagrams and patents once written and filed by Tesla and Company was undreamed of. John had called an emergency meeting of the town council that same evening, unable to contain his excitement, and within the hour the proposal by Paul had been passed with a full allocation of whatever resources were necessary, if and when they could be found, and even a boost in precious rations from the town reserve for those doing the heavy, dirty work for the project. The proposal? To retrofit the dam at Lake Susan down below the college and turn it into a hydroelectric generating system. The few old-timers still alive in Montreat, John's mother-in-law, Jen, being one of them, could recall how there actually had been a hydroelectric power plant a couple of miles above Lake Susan that first provided electricity to Montreat until the big power companies had moved in and taken things over in the 1930s, abandoning the smaller mills and letting them fall into ruins. Jen, as a small girl, used to hike up to the abandoned site and prowl around the wreckage. The day after the decision was made, Paul led an expedition up there to scavenge through the bits of wreckage in hopes of finding abandoned equipment. Some usable pipe, a few rusted gears, and some disintegrating switchboards were dug out, but not much else, other than a rattlesnake, which was quickly dispatched. No matter how hungry he was, John could not stomach the thought as several students quickly skinned the still twitching snake and made a meal of it. The list of necessary supplies put forth by Paul seemed insurmountable at first glance. So many of the items listed in the journals from the 1880s were readily at hand in that long-ago world, but to find them now? In the world of the 1880s, Tesla and Westinghouse could cook up their ideas about this revolutionary thing called AC current and then turn to an army of men with technical skills. Wire makers, steel molders, and lathe operators on down to the sand hogs digging tunnels. The details of how they ventured to harness the power of Niagara Falls for the great mega-project of that time were outlined in the journals in the breathless detail that the Victorians loved to read about. They made it seem easy in comparison to turning tiny Lake Susan into a new source of energy. It presented the classic paradox of attempting to recover a lost technology when the entire infrastructure had been shattered. Tesla, Westinghouse, and Edison created one of the most significant technological advances in history, the ability to create energy at one location and move it to another to perform myriad tasks as yet undreamed of in the 1880s. They created a system that would lead to radio, television, medical technologies that nearly doubled the average lifespan from that of the year 1900, and limitless energy at the flick of a switch. Everything that the world of the 21st century assumed was part of ordinary life, until the day. As they conceptualized those first ideas regarding the still barely understood thing called electricity, they could turn over their drawings to master tool and die makers, precision lathe operators, smelters running blast furnaces, wire makers, and even blueprint drawers. There was a 19th-century infrastructure already in place to make the great wonders of the 19th century, not just the generating of electricity, but the means to get it out there and keep it running 24/7, 365. As a historian, when he was first looking at the plans that Paul and Becca drew up for the town's approval, John felt overwhelming despair. Nearly everything they envisioned for their project had to be made from scratch, reshaped from the salvaged refuse of a collapsed national infrastructure, and it would all have to be manufactured locally, as he examined Tesla's patent application for the essential converters, the precision-made tools that converted the electrical current blasting out of a generator turned by water power into 60 hertz alternating current. It seemed nearly impossible to replicate. So too for the transformers, another of Tesla's near genie-like creations, that could step voltage up for transmission and then step it back down again for final distribution into homes and factories. Paul shrugged off John's concerns with a smile. "I helped with rigging up internet to this campus and kept it running. This is no big deal in comparison." The challenge presented to Paul and Becca by their discovery was ultimately to start the rebuilding of a modern community from scratch. The day had taught all that electricity was the fundamental bedrock of their entire civilization, so ubiquitous that no one really fully grasped how crucial it was until it was gone. John's former students, if successful, would begin the long journey back. If they said it was possible, he and the rest of the community could do nothing less than support them, and all had given the go-ahead even as it strained the community resources, taking dozens of workers out of food production, the bare essentials of survival, with the hope that the investment would indeed start the long journey back from the darkness. As John voted to approve their plan and requests for resources, he quoted the old Joni Mitchell song with the refrain, "You don't know what you've got till it's gone." So the planet moved forward. Anderson Auditorium, a beautiful old structure that was actually a 12-sided, three-story-high building, a popular architectural style for conference centers back in the 1920s, was cleared out and converted into a huge workshop. The interior of a daycare center next to Flat Creek, which emptied out of Lake Susan, was gutted out to be converted into the town's new power station. Out along the front of the dam, part of that structure was torn down, the lake was drained, and even during the coldest days of winter and early spring, piping was laid in and the dam face rebuilt. Lake Susan was a relic of a time when people actually built dams and created lakes for strictly scenic reasons. No one until Paul and Becca came along looked upon the sparkling water falling over the dam's spillway as representing quite a few megawatts of energy. When Paul and Becca, now sporting official titles as electrical engineers, presented their wish list of necessary material, John had told them to move forward, but he did wonder if it was all turning into a pipe dream. The generator would have to be woven by hand with a dozen miles of copper wire. Most of the freestanding, old-fashioned copper wires in the community had literally melted off the poles when hit by the EMP, or had been looted afterward for other such uses as the barely functional telephone system. The turbine of welded steel had to be perfectly balanced. If not, within minutes it would burn out its bearings and either seize up or fly apart. New transformers had to be made. Miles of wire needed to be restrung to run the power from the dam clear down to Black Mountain, and all the other intricacies of actually building a power grid from scratch had to be accomplished. Regarding the copper wire, Paul had uncovered yet another treasure trove that was under their noses, the old electrical substation at the base of the hill where John used to live. It had been heavily damaged by the EMP and further damaged in the battle with the posse, which had been stopped in the area around the station. Paul began to tear the old transformers apart and pull out the copper wiring within them. Most of it was fused into a solid mass from the electrical overload of the EMP. The answer, and Paul in his enthusiasm made it sound simple, was just melt it down and draw new wire out of the molten mass. It had taken weeks of experimenting, of remastering a common technology of the 19th century. One student was severely burned, but they had finally figured it out, and the interior of Anderson Auditorium was now a thunderous, smoke-filled workshop of wood-fired kilns, a foundry, wireworks, and lathes powered by a somewhat gasping old VW engine provided by the town's auto mechanic, Jim Bartlett. Teams were sent out to pull generators and alternators from abandoned cars for their wiring, and batteries for the acid and lead inside. The fact that a meeting and a demonstration had been planned for the evening after the meeting with Fredericks actually came as a welcome diversion after dealing with the crisis of the day, and it was a good excuse for John to keep the open community meeting from turning into an hours-long, dragged-out debate. A small crowd, the team of students and elderly workers who had once labored in the heavy industries of a long-ago industrialized America, was gathered outside the old children's daycare center, rechristened Montreat Power Station No. 1, and actually applauded with enthusiastic delight as John and his family pulled up in the old Edsel. In a way, it was simply a publicity show and test run. The real turbine and generator were still several weeks away from final placement. What Paul and Becca had set up for the evening's demonstration was a 1/6 scale test model housed off to one side of the main floor where the main generator was still under construction. The pipe from the dam face snaked downslope to the powerhouse, thus adding a dozen more feet of elevation drop from the dam face and thus more energy. It was obvious that Paul, Becca, and their workforce had been waiting excitedly for his arrival. Elizabeth, her worries of the moment forgotten, bounded out of the car with young and very sleepy Ben in her arms. Michaela gently helped John's aged mother-in-law, Jen, ever the elegant lady, even at 80, as she braced herself and slowly walked down to where the crowd waited, exchanging greetings with old friends and neighbors. Michaela fell in behind her, John by her side, both ready to leap forward and grab the fragile woman if she should start to totter. The previous 2 years had aged her 10, and no one needed to be told that in this terrible new age after the day, a fall resulting in a broken hip was a lingering and most painful death sentence. "So how are the wizards of electricity?" John asked cheerfully as he approached the waiting crowd in the gathering gloom. There were warm smiles and handshakes all around. John suggested that the two who first cooked up the idea offer a brief explanation of what they had accomplished. Paul was eager to go into a tech-laden lecture, but after a few minutes, Becca simply leaned up, kissed him on the cheek, and lovingly put a hand over his mouth. "He'll go on all night like that," she said with a laugh. "He even does it in his sleep. Doc, we got a good head of water coming through the pipe. All we need to do is open the valve that feeds into our model turbine. Would you do us the honors?" John shook his head and smiled. "You guys built it. You turn it on." They hesitated, and he sensed they were nervous. They had actually resisted testing this out until now, so no one was sure all those old diagrams and their months of hard labor actually would amount to something. They were fearful a premature test run might blow apart all they had labored for so far. The two looked at each other and the several dozen who had worked with them throughout the winter and into the spring. The crowd laughed and urged them on. Together they stepped into the powerhouse, and a joke was shouted that now was not the time to make out in the dark, but to get to work. "I'm not sure how long she'll run, so here goes," Paul shouted through the open doorway, and together he and Becca first opened a valve that diverted water from the overflow pipe, shifting it to run against the turbine blades of their test model. All could hear a vibrating rumble as the turbine began to turn faster and faster, coming up to speed, as Paul watched an old-fashioned gauge monitoring the RPMs. He said something to Becca, the two barely visible inside the gloomy exterior of the control room. Together they took hold of a switch that John thought looked like something straight out of a Frankenstein movie and forced it down to connect the generator and bring it to life. A gasp erupted from the small crowd. Light. Electric light. Electric lighting, not seen in their valley for over 2 years, shined forth from a community power station. Old 100-watt bulbs inside the power station instantly flashing into brilliant, darkness-shattering life. A string of bulbs along the roofline of the building began to glow as Paul and Becca threw a second switch, and even a salvaged string of Christmas bulbs draped along the eaves of the small power station, the same lights that had once decorated the campus tree every winter, sparkled in their multicolored hues.
"Ben, look at the lights! The lights!"
Elizabeth shouted as she hugged her squirming toddler, who was now awake and pointing at the multicolored Christmas lights, squealing with laughter. John pulled Michaela in closer, hugging her. He looked over at his grandson's shining face, and tears came to his eyes. The child, for the first time, was seeing what half a dozen generations before him had experienced from their first seconds of life, and knew throughout their